why do you want to go back to Washington?
I made up my mind to that some months ago because I felt that the issues before us are so grave, the inflation, the unemployment, the general feeling of pessimism by the American people as to their future, the grave perils abroad, whether it's Iran or Afghanistan or Africa, or the buildup in arms, or the danger to the world's money, or the OPEC trust, which is costing us $100 billion a year, an extra cost of oil, and can grind the world to a halt if it stopped. All of these are enormous problems, unusual problems. And I felt that having served longer than any senator in the history of this state, and having the experience and the seniority, and according to my colleagues, all of whom asked me to run, in a very strong way, and the need, if I can, to help change the national administration. The political experts are pretty unanimous about the fact that it's highly unlikely that any other Republican can win this but me. I felt that I just couldn't turn my back on the people at this time. I wanted to quit because I felt that I am entitled to some years of leisure, but I just couldn't. And so I'm joining my resolution and my work to my decision. And I feel I can represent them the best, the most securely, the most wisely, and with the greatest result. And so I've come to them and asked them to nominate me and elect me.
I have a question about the Middle East situation.
Sure.
It appears the Middle East peace talks resumption may be delayed until after the presidential elections because of Egyptian and Israeli fears that there would be some kind of political football in the presidential campaign in the U.S. Are you concerned that this further delay could stall any kind of decision? In other words, might it endanger the very future of that whole deal?
If we are irresolute about it, it might, but if we're resolute about it, it won't, because it's very well accepted that the Middle East is should not be made a political basis for debate, but it should be a debate of a grave issue of our country, but in a bipartisan basis. And that doesn't happen in political campaigns, as we all know. And if the United States has the fortitude to stay with the present negotiation, we are likely to come out all right. It may take us a year or two, but we are. But if we fall for the fact that there should be some big negotiation of all the nations in the Middle East, as requested by the Europeans, our European allies, then we'd be playing right into Soviet hands, because that's where they shine. In the mischief of a big conference which is unwieldy, can't get anything done, and which lends itself to very effective propaganda. So I believe that we should be constant, have fortitude, stay with it, and I believe that if we show that determination, that the thing will turn around. Now, the big nettling problem is the settlements on the West Bank. I do not believe that settlements other than for security are justified. And of course, Prime Minister Begin has insisted that all the settlements are needed by Israel, and that he wants to add a few, and that that'll be the last. That is something like 10. And the opponents of this process have claimed that Begin is simply making it impossible to negotiate, and that includes Sadat. But I'd like to point out that Begin sounded just as determined about the settlements in the Sinai. And when he got a negotiation which worked out the problems, including the settlements, those settlements were given up. So I do not believe that his seeming stubbornness about the settlements is any forecast of what will happen when the parties really get down to a give and take of the negotiation. And therefore, and we, in my judgment, must continue the present course.
The takeover of Jerusalem by the Israelis, how do you view that?
It's not a takeover.
The annexation.
It's not, well, the legal annexation of East Jerusalem is the only thing that that is in fact only a juridically changed fact. They have possession and they are administering it, and they have been for the last 13 years. So it's nothing new in that. I wish they had held off, but I can understand their position. Certainly West Jerusalem is theirs. Nobody challenged that. And also they feel, and I believe everybody feels, that Jerusalem can't be divided. It has to be one unit of administration. And by the way, with an excellent mayor named Kolick.
What would you feel?
And if I may just finish. And so I believe that while it might have been politic to hold off on passing the law, I do not believe that this materially changes the situation.
How would you feel if there was a Vatican-type state set up in Jerusalem for each religion that is there, administered like the Vatican in Rome?
That has been surfaced, and it is certainly an option to be considered, maybe the way to attain a solution. But in view of the fact that I believe so deeply that what's likely to come out satisfactorily is the give and take, the tension of negotiation, as I pointed out about Sinai, I don't want to get into proposing schemes of my own. I don't believe that would be wise, especially from a source like myself, who is considered to be something of an influence in this matter. Well, I think that that's partially my obsession with work, and partially the fact that you don't stand on the main street of town every day and watch me come in and out. I have been here a good deal, but not as often as a couple of months, which is a pretty high standard for six major cities, including New York City and Buffalo. And the reason for that is that as I've progressed in authority and seniority in the Senate, I've gotten unbelievably busy. And I've delivered, by the way, in thousands of housing units and in sewage and water improvements and in the neighborhood improvement plan you have here, where we've got $9 million for experiments in neighborhood improvement. And I think the people have to say to themselves that they want to, and nobody has ever denied that I'm a very hard-working senator, including all my opposition. And indeed, I've been called a workaholic, which I don't like the appellation, but I think it's true that I do work very hard. And there comes a time when you have so much capability for doing things that you simply cannot come up as often as you would like. But I don't think that I get the credit for the frequency with which I do come into our cities and parts of the state. I do a great deal.
DeMato says that he thinks you're too liberal to pull up state New York.
I'm neither liberal nor conservative. I think my best description is a progressive Republican or a moderate Republican. And I believe that I represent the people of this state. That should be the objective of our party, to give the state a senator who represents it, and therefore that I uphold the great tradition of Republicans, which is twofold. One, equal opportunity for everybody, whatever may be their ethnicity or color or sex or race, and second, a heavy dependence upon the private enterprise system. And it's not for naught that for the last 4 years I have been the chairman of the task force on economic policy and a draft of the economic plan published every year of the Republican side of the Senate. So I believe, as I said a minute ago and as I repeat, that it's unlikely that this seat will be carried for the Republicans in this critical time other than by me. And therefore, I believe that it's to the great credit of the party that in choosing me, it would choose a senator who has shown in 4 elections that he truly does represent the whole state and all its people. And that's my aim. I'm not trying to be the Republicans of Republicans. If I were, I'd have been defeated at the most the second time out.
Senator, what are you going to do to bring industry back into New York State? A lot of candidates have been saying that we're in an economic slump in the state, that industry is leaving.
We are in an economic slump in the state, and we have to take advantage of our assets. And our assets are a highly skilled workforce, a marvelous communications network, and a climate that encourages salesmanship and technological progress, and of course a great center of other companies, which is terribly important. Also, we have a great capacity for export and import trade because we have the port to do it. Indeed, 2 ports, you know, Buffalo and other ports in the state, but I'm talking about at both ends of the state. So we have to capitalize on those values. I believe the best way we can capitalize on them is by making them attractive to business, by making a strong effort to get business. In the foreign field, that's especially true. Indeed, most of our export trade is now with the developing countries. We do 40% of our exports with the developing countries, and that's growing. So whereas foreign aid might seem alien to many states, to this state, it should be very attractive because it represents a lot of business for us. And secondly, I think that we've got to accommodate with special arrangements which can be made by states and municipalities, businesses that wish to move in here. And third, we ought to build with this skilled workforce the best labor climate in the United States. And it can be done. We're doing it now in Jamestown, Elmira, and beginning to in Buffalo through the labor management technique of which I am myself the originator. Now, those are some of the things which I believe we can do to give us a better break economically. How we certainly need it. Yeah, please.
How about the tax burden?
The tax burden is very heavy in New York. I think we can make up for most of it. Certainly, we ought to reduce it, humanly possible. We can make up for most of it in the advantages which I have described, plus the fact that I am very strongly for, and the Republican side is very strongly for, tax inducements for new investment, especially in depressed areas, which have very high rates of unemployment that are almost endemic. Among those, of course, are both Buffalo, which has a 10% unemployment rate, and New York City, where the rate is normally 2 points over the national average. So those are the things that I'm striving for.
Thank you, sir.
Which Democrat would you like to choose?
I have no opinions on that. Whoever comes along, I'll take on. All right, ladies and gentlemen, unless there's something else, thank you all very much.
Thank you, sir.
Senator, there wasn't a point of a European proposal to expand the PLO to allow PLO representation?
Yes, it was, too.
I was just curious. Do you think that any kind of bilateral talks between Israel and Egypt can really deal with the Palestinian problem?
I don't believe it's going to deal with the PLO, but it may very well have an influence on the Palestinian problem, depending, I think, upon a settlement which the West Bankers generally would be able to live with.
Is there any way of having a peace agreement without a PLO approval?
I think so. I think you're going to have a peace agreement which involves the inhabitants of the West Bank and Jordan. And if you do, PLO becomes a very dangerous fifth wheel.
Are you favoring some sort of annexation or having
No, it's not necessary. Well, I don't know what, you know, what the practical workout will be, mm-hmm. but annexation is certainly not necessary. Can be autonomous, or it can join with Jordan.
Given the Black September and the fact that the PLO and the other Palestinians were thrown out of Jordan, does that seem a reasonable alternative at this point?
Yes, I think it does. They were thrown out because they're very unstable and unreliable. Group, and because they'll keep the place in ferment and revolution until they get their own state, and then we'll try to get everything, including Israel. And Israel, I think, is thoroughly warned on that score and is taking the position she is, essentially for that purpose.
Okay.
Who belongs to this?
That's your campaign.
I was going to say, it's too valuable.
We have a Japanese.
What? Oh, don't start this.
Tremendous, serious, and peril to labor.
and the Landrum Gurkhanite, and then in our effort to win enough reforms to give labor a parity with management in the organizing drive in unorganized parts of the United States. We lost some, as we did the last time, in labor reform, and we won some. That's life, and that's a democracy. And we'll be back to fight another day for what we lost a year ago. But what has happened also is that history and life have given us yet another opportunity at the most timely moment. And that is, the Lord has taken George Meade from us after a marvelously fruitful and constructive life and great service to the working people of America. And he's given us a new team in the AFL-CIO, Elaine Kirkland and Tom Donahue. And the coming of that new team coincides with a new need in our country, because we are now not only somewhat behind the eight ball in our defenses, and I hasten to add, but I believe we can and will catch up. But we are very much behind the parade in the competition for world business. We are behind the parade abroad, and that we're being skinned alive by the Germans and the Japanese and many others. And we are behind the eight ball at home, where we see in steel and oil what can happen when a business gets obsolescent and when its management fails to keep up with the times and fails to be as sharp as it ought to be. And this is going to require of us totally new alignments, one of which is going to be between management and labor. It is no longer going to be enough for working people to bargain collectively with their employers when they have absolutely nothing to say about the decisions which their employers make, which may mean their jobs a lot more decisively than the collective bargaining itself. Let us remember that the diminution of competition in auto, where the managers of the automobile industry guessed wrong in thinking the people still wanted big cars, and it's almost cost us the automobile business. Or when the managers of steel thought that they could keep out foreign competition, even though they were not attracting the multi-billion dollar investment which was required to bring these steel plants up to par. We've all learned that when those decisions are made, it is not just the investment, the profit, and the stock market that marks their decline, but that it's also hundreds of thousands of workers, perhaps the whole economy, that gets on the rocks because of it. The same is true with inflation. You know and I know that this country is not going to turn its back on the poor, the very young, the lame, the halt, the blind, and the sick. We can do it, and we'll find a way to do it. We have to tighten up. We have to run a tighter ship. We have to do it more economically. We have to transfer a great many responsibilities to others, perhaps the business itself. As, for example, the whole problem of health, the whole problem of new entrants into the labor force, young people, especially from the minority, who need training and who need experience in how to get into the labor force. But we're not going to turn our backs on. And so the question is not what the new reactionary would have us do, but government court on the theory that that alone will deal with inflation. No matter how you come, in a $2 trillion, $400 billion economy, you're not going to resolve inflation that way. What will resolve inflation is to be sharper and better, to produce more, and to sell more. That's exactly what is the, what's biting at us now and bringing about this inflation. And so for the last 4 years, I have been the chairman of the Economic Task Force of the Republican Senate and have urged the very program that we're about to embark on now, a program of inducing industrial modernization and greater efficiency, first through tax incentives, then through more adequate research and development, and finally through much closer cooperation between management and labor. And this is where the labor movement is going eventually to be going. And I believe that Humphrey Donahue is right. First, we have to correct the balance in collective bargaining. And we have to be sure that labor has a full chance with management to persuade workers what is the best way for them. And second, we have to find ways in which there will be greater productivity and greater salesmanship. But we have to be sure, as working people, where we get a piece of the action. Let me repeat that. We have to be sure, as working people, where we get a piece of the action. This is going to happen, sure as fate. You're going to have a tax bill that's going to be very favorable to modernization and to research and development. There's no doubt about our going that route. Indeed, it's essential, even national security, because I assure you, America has never won wars based on being able to match its enemies with every ship, plane, and tank. America has won wars because when we turn the crank, our factories and our mines and our people turned out for goods in such unbelievable fashion as to overwhelm any opponent. Don't copy from the Russians. Beat them. Beat their society. Beat their competition. Beat their way of life. And then the values which we hold so dear will prevail, sure. And so labor is going to have a big opportunity, and it's going to have a big necessity for adding a new dimension, which will call for statesmanship, which will call for very intelligent cooperation, and which will give us a better society, a richer society, and a greater security than America has ever known before. And having worked with these two men, Kirkland and Donahue, for as long as I have, perhaps not as long as Mr. Shankman, father was the other day, having worked with them for as long as I have, I believe that Providence and history have brought two men to the helm, characterizing a spirit which will be the spirit of the future, which the AFL-CIO requires, and which will represent an enormous benefit to working men and women everywhere. Now I propose, therefore, the following, and then I shall be clear. One, that the government needs to consider the establishment of an entity like the Reconstruction Finance Corporation of World War II day and the Depression era, which can offer long-term, low-interest loans to help revitalize business, and with a great preference for fiscally depressed areas, very much like this state, when you look at Western New York and when you look at New York City, which have far above average unemployment rolls. But that kind of help should only be given to businesses that are economically viable, that produce essential goods and services, and that cannot, truly cannot, be helped through normal and private channels. Second, that we deal with our big cities, and that includes surgeons, and I assure you, the happy news for Mayor Alexander, that we deal with our big cities by establishing a means, I call it, a national bank for community conservation, modeled on the World Bank, to help cities and counties to to rehabilitate their physical plant and to bring about better cooperation between management to with officials and public employees for that purpose. If we make our cities viable places in which to live and work, we will put hundreds of thousands of Americans to work, especially in the construction industry, where you're running today in excess of 20% unemployment. Absolutely shocking situation. When America remains to this day underhoused, and when our cities, including our big six cities in this state, are sitting on top of time bombs in every conduit, in every means of bringing energy and other telephone and underground transportation into our cities, which lie under their streets. And finally, if we adopt the technique first used in World War II for the purpose of bringing about a consensus of view between management and labor on issues outside the collective bargaining realm, among these, absenteeism, alcohol and drug addiction. I heard Bishop Harris this morning refer to that in the Mass, and very properly indeed. Quality control and citizens are where labor and management share a common concern. And I'd like to tell you that we have three such committees functioning in the state already with quite unusual success. These are in Jamestown, which is the oldest of the three, in Elmira, and in Buffalo. I'm very honored to be the author of a law which looks with favor on such organizations. And finally, in terms of cutting costs in government and making it possible to have a head as well as a heart, we must consider getting the American business community to take over a good many of the functions which we now consider governmental functions. Among them, for example, I'll give you two. I've mentioned one before. The training of youth and the orientation of youth into being able to get and hold a job. And the other, daycare slots for working mothers. It is a shocking thing that there are only one out of 10 needed daycare slots in this country. And then we raise hell about the fact that there are millions of AFDC mothers. So what do we want to do? Have them tie a key around a five-year-old's neck and turn them loose from 9 to 5 until they can get home from work? It is the fashion in the world, in many of its most successful industrial countries, for factories not only to be places where things are made, but for factories to be colleges and high schools, and also to be places where mothers can put their children safe and secure until they get through with work. Now these are the dreams that I have, and the dreams organized labor should have. Years ago, there was a great complaint in organized labor that when the government wanted to hire officials, the Republican or Democrat didn't turn to the labor movement. They turned to lawyers and accountants and politicians and businessmen, rarely to